Wistful Thinking is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For more podcasts about movies and nostalgia, visit cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
Welcome to Wistful Thinking, where this week we're talking more about the work of Kirsten Dunst. I'm Kara Gail O'Regan. With me is my co-host Jordan Poland-Clark.
Hi.
And today we're going to be focusing on another movie from 1999 starring Kirsten Dunst called Drop Dead Gorgeous, which was a mockumentary about a small town beauty pageant that turns deadly as it becomes clear that someone will go to any lengths to win. And then we'll also be talking about some of her other work because I've watched like 15 of her movies this month. So
I underachieved and you overachieved.
Well, it balances out then.
You say her name like Kirsten.
Mm-hmm.
It's in my brain. It's Kirsten. Kirsten.
Yeah, actually,
which one is correct?
I'm not sure.
I don't know either. The thing that I learned about Drop Dead Gorgeous this time that I never cared about before was that it was directed by Michael Patrick John. I don't know how to say his last name, but he was a member of the State. And a lot of members of the State went on to like be on screen, or like be kind of prolific off screen. But he's one who kind of only did this.
Well, he also directed. It looks like a lot for Reno 911.
He does TV. But I was like, oh, cool. Like, the State just keeps giving and giving and giving.
It's truly amazing. Yeah. It was written by Lona Williams, so it was actually written by a woman. How exciting.
During this movie, there were a bunch of times where I was like, I feel like they're making fun of Midwesterners, and they're making fun of this, and they're making fun of this. But then if you read about her, she was like a Midwestern teenage beauty queen. So I'm like,
yeah.
I guess it's okay.
No, I actually think that this movie could have been a lot meaner.
It could have been a lot better.
Yeah, sure. But like, as far as like the beauty pageant goes, it makes everyone look ridiculous, yes, but it doesn't. I don't know. I feel like it has, like, more respect for the beauty pageant than I would otherwise expect. Because, like, for a lot of women, and, like, you see this in this movie, like, they don't have a ton of choices or, you know, ways to get out of where they came from. And for a lot of people, beauty pageants are. And, like, they're not taken very seriously, but, like, they're as important for kids, some kids, as like, you know, sports and stuff like that are.
Yes. Anyway, I interrupted you. Mm-hmm. What you were saying. Oh, you were talking about the writer.
Mm-hmm. Which she wrote Shark Tale, the movie. She wrote Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse, which I have not seen.
She was a writer's assistant on The Simpsons, and so that's how she started.
Oh, and she's the woman judge.
Yes,
in Drop Dead Gorgeous. I didn't realize that. That's
the
so
woman
funny.
Judge who never says a word and just makes a face the whole time.
Yeah,
because she's also. Where else did she show up? In the furniture store, she's like the assistant. Or, like, works for, oh my god, I can't remember anybody's name. The Kirstie Alley's husband. Does he have a name?
Lester Lehman.
Okay, yeah, Lester Lehman. She works for him, it seemed like, in the furniture store. And he was a real dick to her.
Yeah. I forgot that Kirstie Alley was in this. So she plays the the cast list. I mean, we got Denise Richards, we got Allison Janney, Ellen Barkin, Brittany Murphy is in this, Amy Adams'
first movie.
Let's see who else is on here. Oh, Adam West is in it. As Adam West. Tom Lennon is
The voice.
Oh yeah, I didn't realize that. I didn't recognize his voice.
I did.
I think that's, like, Will Sasso from Mad TV plays a upsetting character.
Yeah, why?
I don't know. I was not as enamored of this movie on this watch as I have been previously. I loved this movie when it came out, and I had seen it several times since then, but I hadn't seen it in a while.
Well, because the parts of it that are good are, like, so good. Like, when Allison Janney and Ellen Barkin and Kirsten Dunst are all together, like, it's gold. Even not without Kirsten Dunst there, actually. Just the Allison Janney and Ellen Barkin scenes are so good.
Yeah,
and
I would love to see, like, a buddy comedy with the two of those.
Mindy Sterling is in it too, who's famous from being in the Austin Powers movies mostly.
Oh, yeah.
She has one of the best lines in the movie.
Which is
when they like are at this big beauty pageant, they're all competing, and somebody's sabotaging everyone, and Kirsten Dunst's, tap dance costume gets stolen, and she's just like done with the bullshit, so she like goes and blames Denise Richards' character, who everyone thinks is the one doing the sabotaging, and so they get in like a hair pulling like girl fight, and Mindy Sterling comes and pulls them apart, and Kirsten Dunst is like, I hate her, and Mindy Sterling goes, I know, we all do. Oh, yeah. It's just, like, kind of subtle, like, underneath some yelling, and it's just, like, the most perfect, honest
Yeah. line. Well, so this takes place in Minnesota, which is a state famous for something called Minnesota Nice, which is how people from Minnesota seem really nice all of the time, but also they're really passive-aggressive. And they're kind of like dicks, but you would never know unless you really pay attention. And there's a lot of that in this movie. And it's like, I feel like is one of the main engines in allowing the action in this movie to happen, because Kirstie Alley plays like what's the actual Miss whatever called?
Oh, it's like Miss something Rose something. Hold on, I'll look it up.
Okay. Well, anyway, she had won when she was a teenage girl. Now her daughter is competing in the pageant, played by Denise Richards. Kirsten Dunst is also competing, but she is poor and, like, works in a funeral home doing hair and makeup. But she's a really good tap dancer, and she's, like, the only one among these girls that actually has, like, a real talent. Well, also the girl that does a monologue from Soylent Green seems quite talented, but in a different way.
Here's the name of the pageant. Sarah Rose Cosmetics Mount Rose American Teen Princess Pageant.
Right. So Mount Rose is the town that they live in. And so that is, I've also been watching season 2 of Fargo, which Kirsten Dunst is on, and she plays
More
another character from Minnesota.
Minnesota accents.
Yeah. She's excellent in that. But what was I saying? Oh, yeah, so Mount Rose is the town, and so the majority of the movie is the town beauty pageant, and then it goes to state and then nationals, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How did we get here? We should have said this at the beginning. We're both, like, real weird and sleepy today. So, this is a weird one.
Yeah.
I feel like we're, like, very ADD a little bit today. How did we get here? How do we get out?
I don't know. Well, this was one of several movies that Kirsten Dunst was in that came out in 1999. It was really, like, a crazy year for her. Because it was this, it was...
Dick, which we did.
Dick? Oh, God. That movie is so good. It was...
Virgin Suicides.
Virgin Suicides, which we also did. It was also the year that she was in the Savage Garden music video for I Knew I Loved You.
Oh, that song was a big deal, too. You. Wow, I don't think I've ever seen the music video.
Yeah.
I'm going to see it now.
And that year she was also in a TV movie that aired on like Cinemax or Showtime or something called The Devil's Arithmetic, which also starred Brittany Murphy. And it's this weird kind of Wizard of Oz sort of story where Kirsten Dunst plays this like bratty, entitled modern teen in the 90s who, just is living her life in New Rochelle, New York. And she goes to her family's house for a Passover Seder. And, it's like clear that she is not at all like connected to her heritage and like isn't really like listening to the elders in the family telling her stories about their past, many of whom were Holocaust survivors. And so she gets hammered during the Seder and then somehow travels back in time
Like you
to,
do when you get drunk.
yeah, you know, the Menashevitz can really fuck you up, but she like gets transported back in time, like into the body of her, I guess, great aunt's cousin. And her great aunt had was like always telling her how much she looked like her and stuff like this. And so they're like in Poland, it's right before the Nazis invade, and then, they do, and it's this whole thing, and they're shuttled off to a concentration camp. I only watched like half of it because it was just like, it was too much. I couldn't really handle it. I have a really hard time with Nazi shit, especially now. But that was interesting. It like wasn't great because it was a TV movie, and it like, the everyone was trying really hard. I'll say that much. But it was interesting, and difficult to watch. So that also came out in 1999,
This is
which.
like, I feel like she was a really big deal between like 1998 and like 2002.
Yeah, I think she really exploded in 99.
Yeah, and then like up until like Spider-Man, I feel like she was like a big deal.
I was gonna watch a Spider-Man, but
Spider-Man.
I haven't seen any of them,
The
and
fr
the
I
first one
feel like the
isn't
first
streaming
one's
anymore.
pretty okay.
Yeah, I was gonna watch it, but it just like wasn't
If
easily
you ever want to have
available.
a fun time, watch the third one.
Okay.
God, it's really bad.
So she's had these like different eras in her career. Like the first was child actress when she was on like Interview with a Vampire and she
But
was on
not like
ER
kid
for a while.
actress, like she was an actress. Like she was good,
Yeah.
you know? No,
Oh.
that's what I mean. She wasn't like in kid stuff. She was doing
She
like.
was in some kid stuff. She was in Jumanji.
That's true, she was. But even Jumanji is not a kid's. I mean, it's a
Yeah,
kid's
it's
movie, but
terrifying.
Jumanji's scary.
Yeah.
Like.
No, she did some kid stuff. Like she did the English version voice for Kiki and Kiki's Delivery Service, which is a Miyazaki film. She was in, oh, she was on Star Trek Next Generation, at least for one episode. She was in Little Women, plays the younger Amy March.
But those
So
aren't
that was
kids'
like,
movies.
yeah, so that was like 89 through 96, 97. Then she gets into like movie teen era,
Yeah.
which is when Dick and Drop Dead Gorgeous and Virgin Suicide's happening. And
And
then
Bring
she
It On.
ages, yeah, and then she ages into Manic Pixie Dream Girl,
Crazy Beautiful.
Crazy
And Eternal
Beautiful.
Sunshine. A little.
Yeah, that's a little bit later. But I watched Elizabethtown, which is a fucking garbage movie.
Gross, glad I
It's
didn't watch it.
so bad. I remembered not liking it, and I didn't realize how bad it is. She is so Manic Pixie Dream Girl in that. It is infuriating. It's just, oh, it's so bad. There's so much Ryan Adams on the soundtrack. Big red flag.
Blech.
Yeah. So she was doing that, and then Spider-Man. But in that time, she was also in Mona Lisa Smile, which I rewatched. And I don't remember watching that a thousand times, but apparently I did because I knew like all of the words. It was really bizarre. Like I couldn't quote anything back to you, but I like knew what they were saying. It was very odd. And I also remembered that that was the movie that ruined me for any art history class that I would go on to take, because it's about Julia Roberts, who is such a fucking movie star. She, like, every time I watch something with her in it, I'm just like gobsmacked at how amazing she is. But she plays this art history professor. Like, it's her first job out of school. She came from California to Wellesley, which is one of the, like, I think the most uptight of the Seven Sisters schools. And it's like 1950 something. I'm not sure exactly. But modern art was happening and had been happening. And so her art history class that she's teaching is about what is art, what makes something art, and, like, you know, exploring this new and different genre that had come to the fore in the last few decades. And she really, like, bumps up against the uptightiness of Wellesley and the system and all of that sort of stuff. And Kirsten Dunst plays kind of her, I guess, her foil. Like, it's, she's one of the students in the class who is, like, clearly extremely smart, comes from, like, a very fancy family, is engaged to a guy from, like, the Jones family, as in Keeping Up with the Joneses. And so they, like, really, like, butt heads a lot. And I don't know. That's a really interesting movie. The cast is incredible. It's mostly women. It's like Maggie Gyllenhaal and, who else was in it? Julia Stiles is in it. Jennifer Goodwin. Marcia Gay Harden is great in it. And that's a great movie. Have you seen it?
No, I remember when it was out and, like, they, like all those, like, young women were in it. And it was, mm-hmm. like, it seemed to me, my read on it, you know, in 2003 when it came out was kind of like, oh, like, cool. They put them all together and they're all, like, I don't know, it seemed like it was, like, their move on from, like, doing those high school movies, kind of.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's a college movie.
Yeah, and so it was, like, I knew that I should watch it and like it, but I mm-hmm. didn't ever see it.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely worth seeking out, because it's really a beautiful film. And she gives them, she gives her class, because paint-by-number sets were, like, brand new at the time, and so she gives them out to her students to do for homework, and it's a paint-by-number of one of Van Gogh's sunflower canvases. And at the end of the movie, they've decorated her office with all of the different versions of it, because everyone painted theirs so differently, and it's... I totally forgot about that scene and was, like, in a puddle on the floor, just, like, crying so hard. It just... I love it. It's so good. So highly recommend that one. That happened in 2003. And then her next movie actually was Eternal Sunshine. And then another Spider-Man. And then Elizabethtown. And then Marie Antoinette, which I was telling you I was watching the other day. I like it more every single time I see it. It is, I think, a visionary work of art that was so underappreciated at the time, but, like, if you revisited it now, is really incredible, and it definitely is something that walked so that The Favorite could fly. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I, like, remember seeing it when it came out, and just not... I'm sure that I would like it more now. Mm-hmm. I can just remember that I thought it was very pretty.
Yeah.
And kind of boring.
And it is.
And that Jason Schwartzman, is that his name?
Yeah.
Was, like, super miscast, and I didn't like it.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. You should watch it again, and then we can talk about it. Because I think, because when I see it now, I see so much more depth. Like, we were talking about, when we were talking about with the Virgin Suicides, that, like, maybe Sofia Coppola makes movies that seem boring because they're about women who have something else like going on that isn't like super on the
Like a
surface.
very deep, like inner life and
Yeah.
like inner process that you
Right.
really can't even actually see, but you're aware that it's there.
Yeah.
But it's very buried, it feels, in her movies.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. But I don't know. I guess it's probably because I'm old, like because I'm older and because I have had like different kind of chapters in my life now that I can understand more the way that that film is structured and like the different chapters in Marie Antoinette's life. 'Cause it basically it's only from when she is sold to the French to like to marry the guy who is going to be king, up through when they are captured during the French Revolution, and then just ends basically. They're in a carriage after they've been apprehended, and the carriage is leaving Versailles, and he says something about, you know, one of the gardens there, and she just says, "I'm just saying goodbye," which is so sad. But you see it like she's so lonely the whole time, and it's like I don't know. I just connected with it so much more than I had when it came out, and it's just like craft-wise, such a beautiful film. Like the costumes are just out of this world, and it's just like visually such a feast for the eyes. And then I think on top of that, there's some interesting like character and story stuff happening.
I feel like Kirsten Dunst has like two levels. One is like what we like want kind of want her to be based on how she looks. You know, very kind of like bubbly, like happy, pretty blonde. And then she has this whole other level that's just like despondent, sad, depressed.
The Kirsten Dunst Depression Extended Universe. Well, so the next thing that I watched was from 2010, and I read an article or an interview with her where she was talking about an acting coach that she started working with around 2010, which was when she says that like things really changed for her. She started taking different choices, like making different choices about the scripts that she was going to work with, and really like thinking, approaching the projects that she took more in like, I want to work with this director than like, I this is a job that they want to give to me. You know what I mean? And so she started working with this new acting coach slash therapist, whatever. And she really, she points to that as like a real turning point in her career. And so in 2010, she was in a movie called All Good Things with Ryan Gosling. Do you remember a few years ago, there was an HBO documentary series called The Jinx, and it was about a man named Robert Durst, who was the heir to some real estate, you know,
Yeah, and he
dynasty.
murdered all his wives.
He allegedly murdered a wife and also
Some other guy.
some other guy
Yeah,
and
a
his
neighbor, something.
friend. Yeah. And this was actually like a like narrative fiction film that they made based on that story in
Oh.
2010. But then in like 2015 or whenever that was, the same director made this documentary, and it was the documentary that actually like led to him finally being like arrested
He admitted it
for,
on tape in the
yeah.
documentary.
Well,
He
he had a
literally
hot
was
mic on
like,
and he went to the bathroom and was like, "Yeah, I killed him."
did it, killed them all. Like,
Yeah.
what? What do you, what?
Yeah. So that's a real truth is stranger than fiction situation that they had like made a whole movie about it and then it got even crazier. But she plays the wife. And she's excellent in it. It was an okay movie, but she was really good.
Oh, this doesn't matter. But now I'm Googling. Was it Andrew Jarecki who made the fiction one, or he made the
and
other
the
one?
Documentary? Yeah, he made both.
Because
of them.
He also made Capturing the Freedmans, which is the best documentary ever in the whole world.
I mean, it's definitely very good.
I mean, it's
up there.
No,
it was
yeah.
like a landmark documentary for sure.
Yeah,
I don't know about the best ever.
No, I know. Okay, I'll draw it back a little. It's just like it's one of the only documentaries I've ever seen where I'm like, I can't decide after watching it ever what I believe.
Yeah.
Which is rare, I think.
Well, yeah, because documentaries so often have a very specific point of view. Like, the way... So, like, I actually was gonna, like, be a documentary filmmaker. I thought at one point that that was what I wanted to do.
I wanted to do that, too.
Yeah, but at the time, it seemed like the only kind of career path was like working in reality television or, you know, working for 10 years on a documentary that no one would ever see. Mm-hmm. Because like, as far as like distribution for documentaries go, there wasn't really like a good channel for that, or not channel, but like, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, but now that there are streaming services, obviously it, you know, increases people's accessibility to documentaries so much more. And so it's like a lot more of a, I think, career path now. I'm not sure.
I know,
but anyway,
I think it's still really, really difficult.
It's still really hard.
Like, it's still very, very difficult.
Yeah, for sure.
To ever, like, make money and be funded and actually make the thing.
Yeah. And like all films, like the amount of documentaries that are made versus the amount of documentaries that are seen, it's like such a tiny, tiny fraction.
You know what? I've seen this movie. I've seen All Good Things, but it was like one of the, like, I turned it on like after, you know, after seeing The Jinx.
Oh, okay.
And kind of like didn't pay attention while
it's
I was
not
watching,
very
it's not good.
Compelling. No, yeah, it's... I mean, it's not that it's not good. It didn't grab me at all, and I was like, The Jinx is a lot more interesting. But I am more oriented toward nonfiction media in general anyway. Like, I'd always rather watch a documentary than like a narrative feature. But what was I talking about? Oh, just that, like, because I was on that track for a while, I wound up taking so many more like documentary ethics and like media studies sorts of and actual documentary production classes, that like we have a much better understanding of like that a documentary is just one way to look at something. Whereas I think most people like watch a documentary and they're like, yep, that's what happened. And like, that's the story. You know what I mean? Versus a team of people worked on this thing and made this thing, and they had to leave out a lot of stuff, and they made very specific choices about what to put in and put.
They had to make it a cohesive movie that a human could watch.
Right. And, like, probably, especially if it's something that's going to go to Netflix or something, a entertaining documentary, which can, like, to make something entertaining can often, like, butt it up against the truth of, like, what actually happened or whatever. So, like, where did we get here from?
I don't know.
Why am I
talking you're talking about All Good Things.
Yeah. Oh, that you said that you watch Capturing the Freedmans, and every time you don't know to think. That, like, most documentaries will lead you to a conclusion, like a specific
conclusion.
Or
you come
conclusion.
Into it, you know, already mm-hmm. having certain feelings about a topic, and so it's
right.
really easy for you to
it
go
either
one
confirms
way or, the
or
other.
Denies your bias. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, the next thing that I watched, so All Good Things was 2010. In 2011, Melancholia came out. So that was the Lars von Trier movie that she was in, which is two different movies and doesn't need to be one movie and definitely doesn't need to be as long as it is.
I also remember thinking that Melancholia was really boring.
It's not that it's really boring. It's just that the first half... So it's about these two sisters who... Kirsten Dunst is super depressed and her sister is super anxious. And, like, both of them are clearly unmedicated and have never heard of a therapist before. But anyway, and neither has anyone in their family. But, like, so it's about these two women, but also in the, like, the backdrop for this whole thing is that there is this planet that they didn't know about before that suddenly, I guess it was, like, hiding behind another planet or something. I forget the exact, like, explanation of it. It's all very... I really like this aspect of the movie. The sci-fi part of it's really cool. But the planet is supposed to make this orbit, like, around the Earth and pass really close to the Earth. So it's going to cause all sorts of, like, weird things. But it's going to be this incredible celestial happening. But also there's, like, a slight chance that it might, like, boomerang back and crash into the Earth. So... these two sisters are kind of like planets that are orbiting and sometimes crashing into each other. And so the first half of the movie is about Kirsten Dunst's character. It's like the day of her wedding, and it's this like big elaborate thing, and it's at some fucking castle, and Kiefer Sutherland is paying for it. Not Kiefer. Wait, which one is Jack Bauer, the guy that was on 24?
Yeah, that's Kiefer Sutherland.
Kiefer, okay. So he's there, he's paying for it, and he's an asshole. And Kirsten Dunst is dealing with some clinical depression, some, like, serious clinical depression, and everyone's like, why can't you just be happy? And so, her entire support system is just full of, like, really toxic and horrible people, and it's this really long wedding. And so, like, the combination, I don't like weddings, I really don't like toxic family situations, so that whole first part of the movie is, like, unbearable for me. And then all of a sudden it's a different movie, and it's sometime after the wedding, don't know how long, whatever, but now the planet is much closer, and her sister is really nervous about it and freaking out, and they're, like, on their estate, and it kind of follows her sister around some more. And eventually the event happens and, you know, everybody dies.
The world ends.
Yeah. I really like the second half a lot. And I really wish that the first half wasn't there.
Yeah, I don't even remember the first half. Maybe I didn't watch it. Maybe I've only seen the end.
Well, so I've seen it twice now. And both times I finished it was like, okay, I never have to see that again.
That's how I feel about most Lars von Trier movies.
Yes, that is 100% like, and I don't even want to watch Lars von Trier movies anymore at all, because we now know that he is a horrible person,
right,
and also a Nazi. So that's not cool. But I watched this one for Kirsten Dunst, not for him. But like the first time that I watched it, I like gets right up to the very end of the wedding part, and I turn it off, and I'm just like, oh my god, I can't handle this. And then I turn it back on, and I'm like, all right, it's gonna be another movie now. And I did that both times that I watched it. It's just weird, and it's exhausting is a good way to describe it. But that's definitely a landmark work, I think, in the Kirsten Dunst depression extended universe. It's also around that time that she actually underwent like an inpatient treatment program for clinical depression. So there were like rumors that she had like gone to rehab for drug abuse or something like that, and she had to be like, no, actually it's just, you know, this instead. She hasn't done any like really long form interviews though.
Ever?
Which I was a little disappointed by, because I would love to hear her talk to somebody like Terry Gross or Marc Maron or something like that. Because most of the interviews that I was able to find with her are just like short press junkety kind of things. Mm-hmm. So she hasn't really talked about it that much in detail. The next year, in 2012, she was in a movie called Bachelorette, which I tried to rewatch and just couldn't, because like... it's supposed to be this way. Everyone is a fucking asshole.
Look,
like,
what a
it's
good cast,
unbearable.
Though. I'm looking at it now. Like, Kirsten Dunst, Lizzie Kaplan, Isla Fisher,
Lizzie Kaplan,
and Rebel
I love
Wilson. Like, what a dream
so
team.
I know. And the woman who wrote and directed it is... Leslie
oh, she
Headland.
Made Russian Doll.
Who made Russian
what
Doll,
What happened?
Yeah.
How'd they mess it up?
I don't know. I feel like this had to happen for Russian Doll to be able to happen, because everyone in Russian Doll is also kind of an asshole, but like,
but
it
in an
works
interesting
there.
Way.
Yeah, and here it's just too much, and I like cannot handle it, and I couldn't really make it past the first 15 minutes on this watch. I did watch it on Netflix like several years ago when it first went on there, because I was like, ooh, Lizzie Kaplan, love her, you know? And I hated it so much. But at the very end, they're at this wedding, and one of my friends from high school was like in the wedding band. And I was like, what the fuck? Did not expect to see him there. So that was a fun and unexpected thing to happen at the end of a very not great movie. I really thought maybe if I rewatched it, it wouldn't be so bad, but it was. So that's unfortunate. The next one that I watched was from that year too, called Upside Down, which was a interesting concept that they didn't quite nail. She's not exactly a manic pixie dream girl in that one. She's more of a memory lost pixie dream girl, which which is kind of the same as Eternal Sunshine, but in this one she had had a head injury when she was younger. But I don't know, it's really hard to explain. It's a sci-fi movie. Like, there's these two planets, maybe they're planets, I can't remember, but they're like right next to each other, and one is like a mirror image of the other, and one is like the upside, and one is the downside of the world. And so like in the upside, everyone's really rich and everything is nice and fancy, and the downside, it's the opposite. And so the guy is from the downside and she's from the upside, and they like somehow fall in love, and it's really complicated. It's really a cool movie visually, but kind of didn't quite nail it on the other stuff. Then she was in a adaptation of Jack Kerouac's On the Road, which I did not watch because no thank you. Oh, and then she was in The Bling Ring. She's like, she makes a small cameo in Sofia Coppola's movie about a true story based on a bunch of LA, or actually they were from Calabasas, which is where the Kardashians live, but group of LA area teens who like robbed celebrities, which was interesting. God, I can't believe I watched this many movies. Okay. Two Faces of January was not great. She plays the wife of a con man. Oscar Isaac is there. He's pretty hot.
Oh, but
hot.
She's moved on to wife roles then.
Excellent point. That is an excellent point, and you're 100% right. She's moved on in 2014 to roles of a wife. I also skipped over one in the Manic Pixie Dream Girl phase from... Oh, fuck. The Cat's Meow from 2001, directed by Peter Bogdanovich, was bad. Not good. Not interesting at all. I've never cared less about a movie. Actually, that's probably not true. But she plays a woman named Marion Davies, who was the mistress to, what's his name? Hearst.
I don't know. I didn't watch it. You did.
Sorry. I just couldn't remember his name. William Randolph Hearst, the founder of, you know, Hearst Media, whatever it's called now. The guy who built Hearst Castle. So you can actually hear an episode of You Must Remember This about this that's way more interesting than the movie. But it's like about this party that happened on William Randolph Hearst's boat, where Charlie Chaplin was there, and some other producer guy. I don't know. It was a stupid, boring story. And it, like, for all of like the potential that's there to make like a juicy story about Hollywood in the 1920s, just didn't, wasn't good at all. Anyway, William Randolph Hearst might have killed somebody and then covered it up. That's
okay, cool.
That's what happened in that movie. And that was a very like Manic Pixie Dream Girl role for her. But you're right, in 2014 she moves on to playing a wife. As far as like what I've seen from this era of her career, like I said, I was watching season 2 of Fargo. She plays the wife of a man who is now her husband in real life, whose name I cannot remember. Jesse Plemons.
Todd from Breaking Bad. Jesse Plemons.
Yeah.
I'm going to hate him forever. I will never be able to like him because Todd in Breaking Bad is like the worst human that's ever existed. He ruins everything. And he ruins
what did
Jesse's
he do
life.
On Breaking Bad? I don't remember.
What?
I don't remember him on Breaking Bad.
Oh my god. He plays, he's a he's like part of this criminal family. But he is like super kind of nice seeming, and you know he has that baby face, so
Minnesota nice.
Yeah, but he is so evil and scary and like,
what season
Todd.
Is that?
It's Todd.
I don't remember him
fucking
at all.
Todd, hate him. I don't know, he like probably the fourth and fifth season.
Okay.
And he has a crush on Lydia, so he like does all this stuff. Like that's like the only thing, the only way he can kind of be manipulated is because he has a crush on Lydia.
That was Chris. That's not Chris. Kristen Ritter, right?
No, that was Jane. She died in the third season, the end of the second season, maybe.
Yeah, I think that was the second season. She is in Mona Lisa Smile as like one of the background women in the art history class.
Oh, that plate, that makes sense.
Yeah, she's like a little baby in that one. I think that was her first movie.
Yeah, so in real life, Kirsten Dunst is married to Jesse Plemons.
Oh, Lydia. Okay, I remember her. Don't remember him.
Wow,
at all.
You need to watch Breaking Bad again.
No, thank you. Fargo is already like way too much murder for me. But she's great on it. He's great on it. They play a married couple. She, and this happens in the first episode, so it's not a spoiler. She accidentally runs over the son of a crime family in the road. And then it takes place in like 1979 or 1980. So she's on this like very 70s human potential. Like, I just got to self-actualize mission. And so she just, he's like in her windshield and she just keeps driving and she drives home and she just pretends it doesn't happen. And then the rest of the season kind of unravels from there. But they're both really good in that. But she's playing a wife. But that show is really interesting because they're dealing with a lot. Like, they're dealing with the women's movement. They're dealing with just the post Nixon America. It was really fucked up in the 70s situation, you know, like there's just like a lot of things, a lot of levels that it's working on. It was really good.
Fargo, created by Noah Hawley, who is like, whoa, I forget if I've talked about this on the podcast yet. I'm reading his book right now. Did
what
we
book
talk about
that?
It on the podcast, or did we just message about it?
No, we were just messaging with Joey about it.
It's called Before the Fall. I'm terrible at reading, but I've realized recently that if I can get like a good horror or like thriller book, like I'm great at reading. I'm like can get super hooked on a book if that's what it is.
Nice.
And so I bought this book on a website used. Because I heard, not the Noah Hawley book, a different book called I'm Thinking of Ending Things. because
oh,
I
you did
heard
talk
that,
about that one.
Because I heard that Charlie Kaufman was going to adapt it into a movie for Netflix, and I was like, oh, surely it will be good if Charlie Kaufman is going to adapt it for something. So I was like, cool, I'll read that book. So I bought that book, and then the website was like, you might also like this book, and it was this book called Before the Fall by Noah Hawley, and I was like, wait, Noah Hawley, who made Fargo and also Legion? Yes, I will like that book. I will buy it. So I did, and it's so good so far. I'm only halfway done. It's about a plane crash, and there are two survivors. One is like kind of a down on his luck artist, and a little boy who is the son of a guy who essentially started like a Fox News type news channel. Mm-hmm. And the other guy who him and his family died on the plane was like a traitor who is about to be arrested for a bunch of like illegal money shit. So it's about like rich people, it's about their lives, and I mean I'm only halfway through, I don't know what happens, but it's like, were they murdered, why did the plane crash, why did these two people survive? And like it's a good story, definitely like I want to know what happens, but I really appreciate the way Noah Hawley writes. Like, I'm just like so impressed that a person could be so good at so many things.
I know, it's really annoying.
Yeah.
All of the characters on Fargo are so, like, the level of quirky detail to them is really wonderful. And that's true of, well, because the Fargo movie was Coen Brothers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's always true of their characters too, but they're, the characters on Fargo are, they all have these like weird and like it feels very organic to those characters, like these interesting traits or interests or whatever. We were talking when we did Jim Carrey about his show that he's on, Kidding, that there was a really well-written character who had cancer on that show, and there's a really well-written woman character on this show who also has cancer. And just, you know, it's telling that story in a way that we don't often get to see. And I appreciate that. Ooh, also, this melted my brain. There's a couple episodes where, like, Ronald Reagan passes through town on his campaign bus, and they cast Bruce Campbell as Ronald Reagan, and it melted my brain.
Love it.
He's amazing. It's like, I never would have thought of that before, and now it's just, like, makes perfect sense. I want to see a whole movie where he plays Ronald Reagan.
I just rewatched the first Evil Dead for the first time in a couple years, and I just love how you can see him really start to shine.
Yeah.
Once everyone else is dead. He just comes alive, him and his beautiful chiseled face.
Yeah. Well, I guess I circle back to Kirsten Dunst. She plays such a weird character in Fargo, and she's so good. And it's a really slow burn, but I'm like, I think I have like 2.5 episodes left, and like, she really is like maybe the most important character in the whole season, which is cool because it seems like it's a show about all these men. But actually, there are some really interesting women characters who are really... Oh my god, Jean Smart is on it. She was on Designing Women. Do you remember how much I freaked out?
I do. You cried.
I cried. I love Designing Women so much. She played a character named Charlene, who was like this real dum-dum from Poplar Bluffs, Missouri. And she plays the matriarch of this crime family on Fargo. It's like so different. She's so good. Oh my god, I love her so much. She did Fargo in 2015. In 2016, she was in Midnight Special, which is a sci-fi movie that I've been meaning to see.
Yeah, I meant to see that too, and I didn't.
She plays a wife and mom in that. She was in Hidden Figures, which I still haven't seen. She plays a racist in that.
It's a good movie. I mean, I liked it. I didn't, like, want to like it. I just, like, watched it for funsies because I had it. And I,
why wouldn't you want to like it?
I don't
it's a
know,
movie
I just,
about women doing science.
No, things. I know, and that's great and awesome. It just, like, didn't feel like a movie that I was going to be, like, really into. And then I watched it and really, really liked it a lot.
Did you see the picture of the woman whose algorithm made that photograph of the black hole possible? She that picture of her, like, posing proudly with all of the hard drives.
Yeah.
Oh, it just makes me so happy.
I saw somebody on Instagram posted a picture of the black hole, and they were like, it looks like a cervix, right? And then you can't unsee it once you see that, because it looks,
yeah,
it does.
Oh boy. Well, sure. Cool. How about that?
Space's cervix.
Yeah. In 2017, she was in The Beguiled, which is Sofia Coppola's most recent movie, I think.
Sounds true.
That was a remake of a movie from a long time ago, about this, like, women's school, small women's school during the Civil War in the South, and, like, a wounded Union soldier happens upon this place, and they take him in, and turns into a real kind of misery situation, but sexier? I don't know. That's a bad way to describe that. That's not what happens at all. It's weird. It's very dark, because they used mostly, like, natural lighting and candles and stuff, so I had to turn the brightness on my TV up to see it. That was very boring the first time I saw it. I meant to rewatch it. I did not get a chance. But it's just, you know, it's quiet and slow and boring. I read one of the interviews that I read. Apparently, Sofia Coppola, like, asked her to lose a little bit of weight for the movie. I don't know why, but Kirsten Dunst was like, no, I hate exercising, and also we're shooting in Louisiana, so I'm eating fried chicken all the time. That's just not going to happen.
Good for her.
Yeah. And then around that time, she also made Woodshock, which is a movie that I love a lot. I also meant to rewatch that. Didn't get a chance to before we recorded, but Woodshock is... was written and directed by Kate and Laura Mulavey. They are the sisters behind the Rodarte fashion label. This is the first movie that they've written and directed, but they did the costumes for Black Swan. Those swan costumes were creations of theirs. So they've worked in film previously, but not on their own film. Kirsten Dunst stars in it. She also executive produced it. And the synopsis of that one is: a haunted young woman spirals in the wake of profound loss, torn between her fractured emotional state and reality-altering effects of a potent cannabinoid drug. So it's this really bizarre and beautiful kind of exploration of grief and also psychedelic drugs. It's great. Also, there are redwood trees. Highly recommend.
I feel like I don't like Kirsten Dunst as much as I wanted to when we started this.
Really?
It's opposite Jim Carrey.
But you only watched, like, two movies.
Yeah, and I don't really care
about
watching
anymore. Both
of which
were from 1999.
Like, I don't know, like, she doesn't, I don't know. I don't find it as interesting. Her as interesting.
I think that you should maybe watch something from this later era of her career. Like, you should definitely see Woodshock.
Yeah, you and Joey have both told me that.
Oh, did Joey see it?
I think so.
Oh, the last time I talked to him about it, he had not. But she's, like, doing something different now. And so if you watch two movies from 1999 and you're like, maybe I don't care as much, like, that's a bad jumping off point for that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
She was also on an episode of Drunk History where she plays Agatha Christie, who apparently at one point in her life just disappeared for a couple weeks. And then, like, showed up and was like, what? I've been here the whole time. She was great on that. But yeah. So that's all the stuff that I watched, which was a lot.
I have no, I can't, I haven't watched any of them. I don't have anything to say about them.
Yeah. Do you have anything to say about Drop Dead Gorgeous?
No, I mean, it would have been better if a woman directed it, obviously.
Obviously.
I think some of the maybe more offensive stuff wouldn't have made it in. I love when she tap dances while she is putting makeup on dead people. It's very
I also love that
incredible.
she like tap dances like as she's walking to work.
Yeah.
Like she is tap dancing forward. It's kind
Yeah.
of, I don't even know if you can do that.
Well, she does. Yeah, I don't know. It was like the parts that were good were really, really good, and the other parts I was like, I don't want to watch this.
Yeah, I actually bought the DVD of it because I was like, yeah, I love this movie. I'm definitely going to want to watch it 100 more times. And it turns out that was not actually the case, which is unfortunate. But I remember seeing it when it came out. I think I saw it like in the theater, and I remember just being like, this is so subversive. Like really blew my mind at the time.
I'm reading Roger Ebert's review
What
because
did
I
he have
think
to
he's
say?
usually pretty spot on. He says, "Sometimes I wonder how anyone could have thought a screenplay was funny enough to film. The script for Drop Dead Gorgeous, on the other hand, must have been a funny read. It's a movie that somehow never achieves takeoff speed." Which I agree with. I bet the script is so much funnier even than the movie.
Yeah. I'm looking at the trivia on IMDb. Apparently, the original title was Dairy Queens, but it
Which
had to
I
be
love.
changed after the corporation that owns Dairy Queen ice cream chain filed a lawsuit. Yeah, that's unfortunate. Although, I feel like it would be, if this took place in Wisconsin, would be a more appropriate title. Because Wisconsin is like known for its dairy and cheese and stuff.
Roger Ebert is talking about, he gives like two examples of things that are like kind of funny when you imagine them, but then when you see them, you're like, oh, never mind.
Which is
He
which
references
parts?
the part where the beer can gets fused to her hand.
Oh, I love that.
No, but I agree with him. Like, I think that it, like, to read that is funny and like
Yeah.
ridiculous, but I don't want to see it. I like, it made me
Oh
feel
no, it's
icky.
a wonderful moment of body
Ooh.
horror
I
that
didn't.
like
I
is
don't like it.
unexpected.
Or it feels like maybe in a different context, it wouldn't have been as weird. And then the other one is the anorexic girl.
Yeah, that's ugh. And also the character that Will Sasso plays,
Yeah.
who has some intellectual disability. And also they say something about, oh, the guy that takes care of him, who is that, his brother, or that
Yeah.
he's one of the judges, like in the epilogue of the movie where they're like showing like what became of each of these people, like his epilogue thing is that he like died from Lyme disease, and now his brother runs the store. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, why that? Like, I
Yeah,
don't
it's
know.
like
And
many
that's like
weird
an extra
choices.
soft spot for me. So I'm just like, why did you have to pick Lyme disease? Why couldn't it have been something that's like, more factually accurate or whatever, anything else?
Weird.
Yeah, I don't know. So yeah, there's like a lot of stuff in this that I was like, ugh. But I think actually some of my favorite parts I thought were going to be during the town pageant, with all the girls. And I do love that scene where, like, during the pageant, they do. Actually, the whole pageant is, like, segment of it is really great. But I love the part with the stools that they
oh
were
my
just
god
painted.
That dance.
So they have wet paint
I
and they're
love
doing this
that
dance.
Part. That made me inspired yeah. to do a circus act where something like that happens
with wet paint.
Yeah, like where because the so they're doing a physical fitness dance as part of the pageant, mm-hmm. and they're in these kind of like skimpy outfits that are red, white, and blue.
Red, white, and
the
blue
shorts
with like
are
white shorts.
And somebody yeah. has painted their stools that they dance with blue and red. Is it more than one color or is it just blue? Anyway, the stools have been
painted. It's blue and white, I think.
Right before they go on. So as they do this dance, they start getting covered in paint. But in places and ways that really like add to the experience of watching the dance. Like they all end up with like perfect handprints on the front of their white shorts and like perfect like blue lines right down their butt cracks. Like it's, I love that part.
Yeah, it's so good. But I really love like the regional and national segments because like in the regional segment she gets there, she feels like super intimidated because there's all of these like professional beauty queens and whatever, and she like they cut funding for the pageant, so instead of being 2 days it's just going to be 1 day, and so they're like trying to shove everything in, and there's this buffet of seafood and everyone's eating seafood, and then all of a sudden everyone starts vomiting everywhere.
But she, I love her reason why she doesn't eat seafood.
Her mom said that you should never eat something that carries its house around with.
Yeah. So she's the only one who doesn't get sick.
Yeah. And so by default, she winds up being Miss Minnesota Teen Rose, whatever.
Because they only have 1 day to do the pageant because they don't have any yeah. money. So they just give it to her.
Yeah. So, well, actually, the whole reason that she wound up there is because the person who wins the Mount Rose pageant dies in a fiery...
Yeah, a lot of people die in this movie.
Float-related explosion. Yeah. So because she was runner-up, she winds up going, and then she is there, and then everyone else gets sick, so she by default wins, and then she winds up at nationals, and they pull up to the headquarters of this cosmetics company that sponsors the pageant, and it's closed. It has gone out of business, and all the beauty queens start freaking out and destroying stuff.
I love
stuff,
that they all arrive so together on the same bus, which makes no sense at all.
Didn't even think about that. Well, you know, maybe they were staying at a hotel, and they all came from the hotel. That's my thought.
Okay. No, I don't think they, because all their luggage is also on the bus.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, I liked that. It made no sense. Continue.
Yeah. No, that's
they,
it.
And they
that's
tear
all.
The shit out of the place. Yeah. And then Kirsten Dunst just sadly gets back on the bus by herself mm-hmm. while everyone else is, like, destroying windows and sculptures and stuff.
But where was she that she gets to be a reporter?
Oh, my God. Right. So then... the person who was actually sabotaging the pageant was the woman running the pageant because she wanted her daughter to win, and her daughter did win and mm-hmm. then died on a float during the celebration. So she, Kirstie Alley's character, so she went to jail for that. And then this was another mm-hmm. part that I was like, ooh, funny maybe to read, but definitely not funny to watch. So then she mm-hmm. escapes from jail and starts a shootout, and she's killing people. Kirstie Alley's character is...
Right, and then the local reporter gets shot.
Gets shot while she's on air, and so Kirsten Dunst just, like, steps in and picks up the microphone and starts reporting.
Well, because the whole, through the whole movie, she's been talking about how Diane
she
Sawyer
wants to be Diane
is
Sawyer.
Her.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's why she's doing the pageant. And so then she, you know, reporting live on the scene, and she gets to be a reporter, which is nice. Yeah. I just saw this trivia bit, though, while you were talking. The town of Mount Rose is fictional. and is an anagram of Rosemount, where screenwriter Lona Williams graduated from high school. However, all the other Minnesota cities mentioned in the film, wait, no, I'm reading the wrong one. Here it is. All the other cities are real cities. Sorry. The movie makes multiple references to traditional Minnesota food. The Mount Rose High cafeteria serves lutefisk for lunch. Jell-O salad is served at Tammy's funeral. And if you heard our What Am I Chewing episode from last week, you heard us talk all about Jell-O salad.
About Jell-O salad.
And several scenes included people eating and offering bars, considered an essential dessert for Minnesota potlucks. I think this was like the first time that I had ever heard a Minnesota accent, and I just thought it was the funniest fucking thing in the world when I saw this in like 1999. Just like, Minnesota.
One of my roommates is from, oh dang, I can't even remember where she's actually from. Somewhere over there. I'm a bad friend. I can't remember. But she has that accent every once in a while, and so she'll say like bag for bag. It's cute. And then we all make fun of her a little, but then we all do it also. Big.
Yeah. I don't know. Do you have anything else?
I don't think so.
I guess the only other thing that I was thinking about was that in one of the interviews that I read with Kirsten Dunst, she was talking about how she's really good at silent acting. And that tickled me because I had noticed that she's a good silent actress. Like, there's a few, like, in Bring It On, both Bring It On and The Virgin Suicide, she has, like, silent flirting scenes. Mm-hmm. In Bring It On, it's her and Cliff, and they're, like, brushing their teeth next to each other. And it's, like, completely silent, but they're, like, flirting and, like, looking at each other and, like, spitting out toothpaste. It's really weird, but it's really cute. And then in Virgin Suicide, she has that, like, silent flirting with Tripp while they're watching
the movie
or something at school. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I don't know. You definitely have to, I would recommend you either watch some of season 2 of Fargo.
I couldn't and hardly or Woodshock. Do the first season. It was really stressful.
This one doesn't feel that stressful. It actually feels very kind of slow and plodding.
Okay. I can do that. I just couldn't.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I finished the first season, but I had to turn it off like many times because of the violence and the, it just made me feel icky. I didn't like it.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a lot more violence in this than I would. I would have never watched it if not for quote unquote research purposes, you know? And also because I heard an interview with their production designer recently that was interesting. But, the first few episodes actually were, like, it took me a while to get really into the story, and now I'm, like, extremely attached to all of the character. Ted Danson is on it.
I do love Ted Danson.
He's just such a delight, you know? I feel like there's a lot of, Nick Offerman is on it. Like, there's a lot of really great people on it. And it balances, I think that there's a good balance of, like, comedy and seriousness and stuff. And that, the worst characters, seeing some things happen to one character in particular, like, he has this daughter that he's abused her whole life, and then Kirsten Dunst, and his daughter is, like, a young blonde woman, and then Kirsten Dunst winds up kind of, I don't know, maybe torture is the wrong word for it, but it's, like, very satisfying to see someone who's basically, like, a proxy for his daughter who he's abused so much, like, beat the shit out of him, you know? I don't usually like watching violence, but whatever. There's no violence, I don't think, in Woodshock. So you can watch. I mean, people die, but it's not violent.
No, I don't. There's just a certain kind of violence that I mind. And I can't even, like, every once in a while, it'll just feel, like, too real for me. Like, mm-hmm. the way like the way the bullet got stuck in his hand in the first season, and that it wasn't even.
Oh, I didn't watch
violent.
The first season.
Oh man.
Yeah. I was actually really relieved that it's an anthology show because I was like, oh, I don't know. Can I like pick it up in the second season? And it's a completely different story.
There's a character in the first season who's just like kind of the worst. And during a shooting incident, he gets like a, I don't even remember if it's a bullet, if it's like a pellet of some kind stuck in his hand. And because he's like trying to like keep all the pieces together of what actually happened because he committed a crime, he just lets it sit there, and it's like a focus. It keeps going back because his hand is getting really infected, and it was just like a level of like gross body stuff that I was
gangrene.
Like, oh,
yeah.
I can't watch this.
Yeah, you're not into body horror at all.
I am though. I like it. I like it when I'm expecting it. Sometimes when it feels like too real, like too realistic, I'm just like. Oh.
Also, I think that there's like some sort of like innate reflex that humans have with gangrene. Like it's so revolting because it's like so dangerous, you know?
Yeah.
Like it's just like a natural reaction because it is like. Really horrendous. There's not a I was gonna say there's not a ton of like gore and body horror in season two, but Jesse Plemons does wind up having to cut a man up and shove him through a meat grinder, so there's that. He's a butcher.
How Fargo.
Yeah, he works in a butcher shop, and it's like
also a very Sweeney
Todd. I think
it's
like the very first. Yeah, I think it's in, like, the very first or second episode, like, all three people that work in the butcher shop just basically have this entire conversation where they're all just saying, okay, then.
Like, very Minnesota.
But anyway, have we been recording for long enough? Yeah, that's good enough for an episode,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Man, we made it. Sorry if this episode was boring and sleepy.
Because we're boring
just
and
me
sleepy.
Rattling off Kirsten Dunst movies. Yeah.
So you could go to Wikipedia and read all that yourself, but you could also listen to Kara read it to you, and she has a nice voice.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. I'm feeling particularly vocal fry today, but that's just because I like lost my voice yesterday.
No, my aunt loves your voice.
You.
So I was telling you that, like, my aunt listens to this podcast.
Hi, what's her name?
Karen.
Hi.
and she always loves your voice.
Oh, that's so nice. Well, I watched all of the Kirsten Dunst movies, so you don't have to. But if anyone wants some recommendations, I'd say definitely Virgin Suicides. Definitely Dick. Definitely Eternal Sunshine. Definitely Mona Lisa Smile. Definitely Marie Antoinette. And definitely Woodshock and season 2 of Fargo. So that's about half of the stuff that I watched. Which is not a bad... It felt like a slog. But I guess, like, it works out to pretty good ratio. I guess. So if Jordan, if people wanted to find you, where could they look?
They could find me on Instagram at JordoPC.
Doing circus stuff.
Mostly circus stuff.
But sometimes other things.
Every once in a while, yeah.
Cool. You can find me on Instagram at Bimps, BIMPSE. You can find the podcast at Wistful Pod. And get caught up on all our older episodes of both Wistful Thinking and What Am I Chewing in this very podcast feed or at cageclub.me, and we will what are we doing next month?
I don't know. We're following our own rule, we're going back to a 90s male comedian.
But we don't have to follow our own rule because it's not a real rule.
No, but let's think about it. It's the only structure we give ourselves.
Okay, well, this doesn't fit in that structure, but I nominate Drew Barrymore. Yeah.
I'm gonna feel the same way about her that I did about Kirsten Dunst.
Yeah,
I
but.
have, here's the thing though, here's my problem, is like, I just don't have any attachment to her. So it's not like a fun, like, thing. Like, not that I wouldn't enjoy maybe watching some of her movies, but I don't have any attachment to doing it, you know? So, like, for our podcast purposes and for my own, like, interest purposes, it's not as fun.
Yeah, but I had no attachment to Jim Carrey.
Yeah, until you did.
Well, that's you might have a
But you
attachment
did
to
have,
Drew
but you
Barrymore.
had, like, memories of Jim Carrey movies.
Yeah.
Like, same for Mike Myers. You at least went into it with, like, oh, you know, I've seen this before. What's this like
Yeah,
now?
but you might wind up have you might realize as you're watching some of her movies that indeed you do have memories about them.
I'm skeptical.
Okay, well, Ever After is a really good movie, and I would love to talk it about it on the podcast
God, I
sometime.
didn't even
So
like
that
that when I
was.
saw it when I was 12.
Yeah, but if we've learned anything from this podcast, it's that watching something when you're 12 versus when you're 32 or 33 is a completely different
Yeah, I don't
experience.
know. It doesn't appeal to me at all. You can keep trying to convince me. We'll talk about it, but it does not appeal to me.
Okay. Well, we'll figure it out. And we'll talk to you next time on
Bye.
Wistful Thinking. Bye.